Welcome to the Live Retail Online Integration and Direct Marketing Association webinar called From Operations to Branding, Best Practices for a Smoother Cross-Channel Retail Experience. My name is Melissa Campanelli, and I'm Editor-in-Chief of Retail Online Integration, and I'll be your host for today's event. How do you get ahead of your competitors and stay there? That's the billion-dollar question. The answer is probably not one big idea, but lots of little things that come together to make a big difference. We've brought together three experts today in the field of cross-channel retail: Lois Brayfield, president of J. Schmid; David Kravitz, the co-founder of Fairytale Brownies; and Elisa B. Lowry, the COO of Venus Fashions, to talk to you all about making your operations more efficient from the back end to the front. They'll share tips gathered from their years of practical experience in a fast-paced and lively discussion that's a preview of the session they will be part of at the Direct Marketing Association's Forum for Cross-Channel Merchants that's taking place in May. That session is called Survivor Panel, 60 Tips in 60 Minutes. Today, listeners will learn how to make your back-end operations a key part of your branding strategy, best practices around operations and fulfillment, key customer service strategies, and so much more. Before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select ones, as I said, at the end of the hour, but send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can use all of the widgets and bells and whistles on the console. And speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on this console do and how you can customize your experience today. Before we get started, however, I just wanted to let you know about a special offer the DMA is offering to register for the Forum for Cross-Channel Merchants. If you register with the discount code WEBROI, that's W-E-B-R-O-I, you'll get an extra $100 off. So register today at crosschannelforum.com. So with that, take it away, Lois.
Well, thank you, Melissa. I appreciate the introduction. We're very excited to present the session, and the three of us have decided to just choose 5 to 8 tips that will represent the broader session that we're going to do with the DMA. And they very cleverly presented the conference in three different buckets, which really kind of encapsulate the entire experience: to inspire your customer, offer a good fulfillment experience, and then delight them on the back end. And so we've loosely created these three buckets, and we'll be going through. And I'm the first one that's going to share ideas on how to inspire your customer. And I've chosen 5 things that are just very hot topics right now that you should consider, with the first one being something that we all know, but it turns out very few brands truly, truly know their customers. And it is so critical in this day and age. And the brands that are really doing well and growing rapidly are the ones that have done a magnificent job of researching their customer and truly getting to know them, and not just about demographics only. What we have found is that, you know, what's important to our customers is rarely what's important to us. We can market all day long, but unless we know what's important to them on many different levels, not just in your category, the smarter we are about marketing to them. And in this world where our consumers are constantly being bombarded with different things to entertain them, both online and offline, we have to understand, where are they going to spend their time? Where are they being entertained? So it's important that we understand these dynamics. And the good news is that research has become very affordable, whether it be a panel of your best customers that you can constantly ask questions to, or whether it be an affordable online survey that you do. But as long as you ask the right questions, and as I mentioned before, it's so critical that you ask questions beyond just demographics, like, why do they really do business with you? You know, why do they choose you? What do they really care about, whether it be in your category or others? Another one I love to use, you know, what are the words that they use to describe your brand? Ideally, you want to ask your very best customers, you know, what are those kinds of words, and even create a word bubble or something that your marketing team can use and reflect on when they're developing messaging. How do they seek out your category? What's the experience for when they're looking for something in your category? If they're looking for a pair of shoes, what do they do first? You know, do they go to the store first? Do they go online first? What is that entire experience from start to finish? And then what marketing forums do they participate in? And what I mean by that, you know, are they involved in Pinterest? You know, do they go on Facebook? Are they involved in Twitter? What are the things that they do so that we can better infiltrate their world and market to them in a more relevant way? And then, you know, last but not most important is, do you really, really, really know them? And I strongly encourage all brands to create what we call these personas. And they've been getting a lot of hype in the last couple of years. But I have seen just incredible things develop when a customer truly understands who their customer is. And this is just an example of a client that we have that has developed a primary customer persona, a secondary, and a tertiary. And in a one-page document, even with a picture attached, they can quickly get the essence of who they are, how they want to be spoken to, how not to pander to them, you know, what kind of offers do they want, those things that you really, so you can really truly understand. And then even if you want more granular information, there are wonderful psychographic overlays that you can place on top of them to find out where do they go on vacation, what do they read, you know, how do they spend their downtime, are they involved in the community, all these different things that will allow you to better market. And when a company truly understands the customer, then you can affect the experience at all levels, not just up front, but throughout the entire experience. The next one is really what I call understanding your higher order benefit. And what that means is the reason why. Why do they truly shop with you? What is the emotional reason that they choose to do business with you? There's been a lot of research over the last couple of years about neuromarketing, and they've been able to prove that there are certain parts of the brain that light up when you've hit an emotional chord with them, whether it's, you know, your product makes them look cool, or whether it's the desire to collect things, or fear of not having something, or craving something. And while most of us can't afford this high-tech process where we actually examine the brain and see what lights up, we can, through, again, research, find out what those reasons why. To give you an example, here's just a couple of brands. You know, Starbucks isn't about what they own, which is, you know, gourmet coffee created by baristas. It's all about the ability to escape and indulge. That's the higher order benefit. Or Target, they allow me affordable style. Or one of my favorites, the last one there, Apple Computer. You know, it's not about the really cool, sleek, simple gadgets that they, tools that they give us. It's allowing us to reach our creative potential. They've actually stated this as their higher order benefit. To put it into a multi-channel world, here's an example of a cross-channel company who sells both online and through the mail. And they understand their customers. You know, the one thing that they provide their customers is the fact they provide these miracle suits that will allow them to look 10 pounds lighter in 10 seconds. But that's not really what they're selling. They say it right up front in their tagline, "We love curves." But the higher order benefit is the word competence. By, you know, these women wearing these suits, they have more confidence because they, you know, assumably lost a little weight, and they feel more confident because they can wear these suits and look better out in public. So that's a great example of a higher order benefit. Okay, so the next one, give customers a reason to engage with multiple channels and tactics. Everybody knows we are just bombarded with multiple tactics. It's incredible, you know, what, you know, Pinterest is the latest craze right now. They're constantly coming out with new things, and we have to ask ourselves, where should we focus our time? And in the last year, most of you probably used a QR code because we got postal discounts of it, with it. But, you know, unfortunately, I don't think anybody really developed any kind of strategy on how we were going to eventually monetize this. So this is just kind of a quick checklist to ask yourself. You know, first of all, does your customer really care about this tactic or what you're about to ask them to do? And probably one of the most egregious things that I've seen is we don't have a strong call to action where we invite them in and give them a real reason to interact with our brand at this different level. And then flawless execution. Most people do pretty well at that. But then the next one is another thing that I'm seeing is that we get them there, whether it's through a QR code or we get them to Facebook, whatever it might be, we don't have any strategy to really engage on things they care about, but then more importantly, to convert. And a great example of this is a food catalog that we worked with. They had a QR code that invited them to really good monthly deals, and they would change it every month on the back end, allowing them to extend the life of the QR code. But once there, they had one single offer to make it really simple, and they had a thumb-activated buy now button or call now button that would, you know, self-populate the phone number and they could immediately order. It was hugely successful for them, and they were able to measure, which is one of the most important things. Here's a great example. You know, most people will do this, and they do it very well. Follow us online. I say, who cares? Pottery Barn actually had this one where they did pretty good. It said, follow us online, and it gave them a reason. People could find ideas and designs and connect with other fans. But what if we turned the mirror over to the customer and made it all about them? And this is what I mean by developing a strong call to action. So making it all about them, discover your design style, find decorating ideas, entertaining tips, and find help for your next project, giving them a real benefit. L.L. Bean, I think, does a really good job with this, and here's a couple of examples. As long as their customers really care about this, you know, taking a closer look at product details or live help online, a real good reason, helping them decide between one sheet and another sheet, or actual comfort ratings that for outerwear, lots of different ways they do it. And I think they do a really good job, but it's getting that reason why in the call to action. The next one is all about inspiring prospects in a new way. We've treated prospecting kind of as a one-and-done thing. We buy lists. If they buy, it works. If they don't, we've lost that opportunity to market to them unless we buy the name again. And this recent statistic that I read about a year ago really kind of got me thinking. If a consumer engages with a brand in any way, they are 63% more likely to purchase a product in the future. Okay, so how can we take advantage of this knowledge in any direct marketing application? Is there a way we can get them to engage, get them to leave behind their name, and then market to them later? You know, saving our dollars on those all-precious lists that we constantly are buying. Here's a couple of examples of customers that have taken advantage of this concept with good success. One, again, CyberSwim, who I introduced before, had the Miracle Suit Makeover in which people had to go online, whether they wanted to buy a product or not, and leave behind their name and an email. Or Orvis, who had an online auction with a fully restored 1959 Range Rover, and they had hundreds of people sign up just to be a part of it. It was hugely successful. Or Pottery Barn, who had a win a trip for two to Paris, and it was so well presented in a cross-channel application in the retail store online, and they had thousands of people sign up for this that allowed them then to market on the back end. So whether it's a list you're purchasing or you're spending money on search, getting them to your site, what are you going to do to get them engaged at any level so that you can market to them later? One of our clients actually was able to gain an additional 1.2% response of people willing to raise their hand and leave behind a name for a downloadable document that was relevant to their world. And then they were able to convert an additional 28% of them through a series of triggered emails. So think about prospecting different, not just as a one and done. And I'm going to share with you, I love this list that Tony Hyde did with Zappos. He has this acronym called ICY. That whatever you ask them to do, make sure it's interesting, compelling, entertaining, or educational. If it's not, don't do it. And then my last one that is very near and dear to my heart, because I think a lot of traditional direct marketers really are having trying to get the slide to advance. My apologies. Well, I'll go ahead. And that is, oops, a little sneak preview there. And that is, I'll go ahead and talk about it. That's the concept of what I call being bold and different, but authentic. Let's see if I can't push this slide. There we go. Being bold and different, but most importantly, being authentic. It's the brands that are being different, that are trying new things and thinking outside the box. They're really growing exponentially right now. And it's because our brains are hardwired to notice what's different. Just as in this slide, you notice the redfish before you notice the sea of blackfish. This is such an important concept, one that certainly Geico figured out with their lizard, as well as the Progressively flow. You know, they took a category in which everybody competed, kind of selling the same kind of thing, but by being different, they got noticed. And we're seeing several brands doing things like this, like JCPenney and even Target. And in the direct world, you just don't see that much of it. And I'm going to share one that I think is just really doing a fantastic job. Let's see. And that's JL Pal. If you get the chance to request this catalog, I strongly recommend that you do so. They have done just a magnificent job of being bold and authentic and trying things that many catalogers wouldn't dare to. And as you see by the slide, just the photography alone is very, very authentic. And they don't have an off-the-shelf model. This is, looks like a real guy with the 5 o'clock shadow. And the shoes that they're selling there are actually in use with water splashed on them. And the inset, you know, he's smoking a cigar. Who does that? It's very rare. Or drinking what looks like to be a beer. You know, they're taking risks, but it really aligns with their brand, which is all about their motto is, Their motto is all about a life well lived. And right on their website, they say, this means a healthy disrespect for the norm. And so their catalog is doing that, taking these kind of chances. And one of my favorite images in their catalog is this 1,000-mile boot. And instead of just showing it in a very pretty way, you know, with beautiful in-studio lighting, they have mud on it, which is, again, authentic and is bold, and it's working for them. They're doing very well. Well, it keeps backing up. So I want to finish my section by just leaving you with this quote that I think is very relevant to this idea of being bold, trying new things, and that is from Bob Dacher of OfficeMax. He said, the secret is respecting the consumer. You are interrupting their life. All advertising is unwanted, so if you're going to crash the party, bring some champagne with you. I think that's an excellent quote. All right, I'm not sure why this is... So I'm going to go ahead and advance to David, and hopefully it keeps repeating itself, Melissa, so I'm not sure. I'm just going to...
Yeah, that's okay.
There we
go. We'll move forward. Yeah, it's just a matter of moving it forward because of the, just because of the graphics.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
Okay. All right, well, thanks, Lois. That was some great insight in how to think a little bit more deeply about our customers. And like Lois said, I mean, we're interrupting their life, and we want to make it a great experience. So I'm just going to throw out a few ideas about how to make the fulfillment piece, once we've acquired the customer, how to make that fulfillment piece a great experience for them, both from their side of point of view and also from the back-end operational point of view. What can we do to fulfill our packages more efficiently and get the product to the customer as fast as possible, because that's what they want. So we're going to, at the conference, we're going to be throwing out an idea a minute, and you'll also, if you come, get a chance to vote us off. It's going to be a survivor style, so if you don't like our ideas, you get to vote us off the panel. The first idea I have here is basically lose the peanuts, and it's not just, I mean, everybody knows that customers hate opening a box filled with peanuts, and you know it happens time and time again. And it's not just about losing the peanuts; it's about what is the experience when the customer receives the box. Is the box easy to open? Once they open it, is the product going to be, you know, in good shape? Is it going to be easy for them to dispose of the packaging? Certainly peanuts are not. You know, some other options like I show here, you know, this is like a crumpled paper type idea, and, you know, machine crumples that for us. There's also the pillow packs, that, you know, which are, I think, better than peanuts. You know, for me, I still have to pop the pillows or I have to cut them up to get them into the garbage can. But, you know, it's just about thinking from the customer's point of view. I've seen some nice boxes that have tear strips to get into them. I know Amazon's got a whole team that works on improving the packaging and making it easier, and they encourage feedback from the customers. So just think about what the experience is once the package arrives and they get into the box. Next here, I just wanted to reiterate that your box does represent your brand. And for us, you know, we made a decision to go to a white box. It's got our logo. It's got our website. You know, it is a little more expensive. Let's see, it went backwards on me. We also spent a few extra pennies to do a coating. The box has a sort of a satin varnish applied to it, which keeps it cleaner in transit. You know, the white box does get dirty, so you know, everybody's got their different sort of price restrictions and cost restrictions, but for our brand, it was important to really, you know, create this wonderful experience when the box shows up, and that includes, you know, the point where they're handed the box from UPS or FedEx, and they're excited, and, you know, there's a lot of brands that do some whimsical statements on the outside of the box, and so really think about, you know, what the package looks like when the person receives it. Here's an idea that we implemented last year to make our certain of our shipments. In this example, this is an overnight shipment, and we happen to use a color printer for some of our collates, and one of our team members came up with this idea, which was to highlight the overnights with this sort of day glow color, which, you know, we got approved by the shipper ahead of time. And when, you know, our fourth quarter holidays is our busy time, and we're pushing through so much volume that it's easy to, you know, misplace one of these urgent overnights. So this is a great help in just making it stand out on the line and get it separated from the main shipping so that it gets put in the proper trailer. Now, if you're not using color, you might consider some other options here with some, you know, icon or some pattern or something that makes your packages stand out if that's something that's important in your shipping line. We actually create our own collate, and we take the data right out of the back end and lay it out just the way we want it for each order. So we don't use the vendor's predefined form anymore. All right, moving on. The next item I wanted to talk about was just encouraging easy customer feedback. And this is something that we do that actually goes in the shipping box, and it's a postage paid business reply card. And it asks a few questions. It's very simple. It asks, you know, what was the condition of the packaging? What was the quality of the product? What was your overall experience? I think we have four questions. They can rate it, let's see, excellent, good, fair, or poor. And we do have a policy in customer service. All these cards come back to customer service. We have a policy that if anybody checks fair or poor in any of the categories, that there's automatically going to be a customer service follow-up with that person. And oftentimes, you know, we'll just send them a small box of brownies with an apology, or we'll call or email them to follow up and just let them know that we heard their complaint and that we're responding to it. We do tabulate all this information. We also have a question on this card that asks for new product suggestions, and that's been very helpful for us in developing new products. So we tabulate if somebody's looking for a new flavor or a new packaging or a new gift item. We use this data to help us develop new products. There is a drawing on there. It says, you know, win a free box of brownies. We have a drawing once a month that really encourages the return. And then we also implemented something new this past holiday, which was to put the QR code right on the card. And we've gotten a pretty good response on that, where the customer can scan the QR code and they're taken to a very simple mobile app, which has the exact same questions that are on the card, and they can just do it on their phone and it gets emailed to customer service automatically. All right. The next item here, this is now more on the back end. It's just a quick, easy idea here for something that you can do that's low-cost, big payoff, and that is dual screens. This is something we first implemented in customer service because they were using our order entry system on one screen and searching the web on the other for address corrections or helping customers with issues where they need to do tracking. But we have found this is really beneficial to any team member, whether it's IT or shipping or accounting, graphic design. Everybody wants a bigger screen. We started doing that, and finally we realized that, you know, the two screens was the way to go, and it does not cost a lot of money, and everybody really has found it to be a big payoff in efficiency. All right. Here's another idea in the warehouse. This is about color coding aisles and packing stations. We do hire a lot of seasonal team members. There's, you know, limited amount of time for training. We have team members that English is their second language, and so we've over the years tried to really simplify the pick, pack, ship operation as much as possible. And this is something we implemented last year where we're color coding the aisles. You can see there are some flags that show the different aisles. And then each packing station has a corresponding color code. And this is for us, it's basically by the type of product that they're packing. So the picker basically is given, their picking slip. They go, they know what color aisle they need to head toward. Once they've picked it, they know what color packing station they need to deliver it to. And then we've got a picture here that shows multiple colors. So these are going to be the more complex orders that get assigned only to our regular team members. And so that's going to have basically a little bit of everything at those few stations. All right. And the next idea here, this in some respects this is almost going backwards from a technology standpoint, because I'm talking about checklists and simple folders, but for our business we do run into some pretty complicated orders. These could be orders that have hundreds of shipping addresses that all need to be validated. It could be something that's customized where the customer is going to put their logo on it, so it has to go through a lot of different steps to make sure that we've done the proper customization, we've checked the addresses, everything's validated. And so over time we've developed this simple checklist. It's color-coded. We have one checklist that means it's a custom order, which means the customer's logo is going on this gift, or the other color is basically just a standard packaging. But these are all used for really large shipments, multi-ships, where it could be, you know, as many as 1,000 addresses on a single order. We used to sort of paperclip it all together, and, you know, that doesn't work too well when you've got a big stack, so we went to these job folders, and basically it just moves along the line. Everybody checks it off. Nothing gets shipped until it's got through, all the checklist, and then it's finally released for shipment. And then so my last suggestion here is just on payment method, and we did implement PayPal this past holiday season. We found it to be very easy. PayPal has many different ways that you can integrate with them, and so we had received a number of requests from customers, and we found that immediately, you know, within just a couple weeks, that we were getting about 10% of all of our orders paid via PayPal. And from an IT standpoint, it was fairly smooth as far as IT projects go. So those are a few different ideas. We're going to have plenty more at the conference. We hope that you can all join us. And I'm going to pass off to Elisa now, and she's going to tell you about how to delight your customers. Here you go, Elisa.
Thank you, David. I told everybody I get the good part, the delight. I always like being a customer myself because it's the little things, and I guess that's the best way that I can probably, you know, relate to our customers is, you know, how do I want to receive this? One of the first things that we try to teach all of our agents when they're talking to the customers, because they are really our contact with them, whether they're doing it via chat or over the phone, is to kind of expand on what Lois said, be authentic. Get it to them as promised. Don't make the customer a promise that you can't keep. Let your customer know when to expect your order, and then get it to them when you say you will. I know that we're all using economic delivery services to control, you know, our ever-increasing freight costs, but the honest, just be honest in the expected delivery time. I know a lot of us are using, you know, carrier services that have partnered with the U.S. Post Office, and our carriers are actually fulfilling, you know, their 1 to 5 days, depending on where you're located. But then once we put it in the hands of the post office, it really could just depend. And we've experienced, you know, adding on quite a few days to our delivery time, but we just let the customer know up front. And as long as they don't have an expectation other than what we've told them, then they're going to be delighted when they get it in their hands. One thing that we have found, just because we are, you know, all having to use some economic delivery methods, is that we will actually offer a faster delivery service for our customers to pick, to have control, you know, without breaking their bank. So in this day of offering lots of free shipping and handling promotions, what we've done is if the customer actually qualifies with their order for the free shipping and handling promotion, what we'll do is we will now give them a suggestion to go ahead and upgrade to like a 2-day service for a very nominal fee. And we have quite a bit of success with it, you know, about a 45% conversion on the customers that are like, oh, yes, you know, if I've already qualified for free shipping, I'm not paying that, so I'm gonna go ahead and chip in a few extra dollars and then get it, you know, get it to them faster. Our customers have been very pleased with that. Do the unexpected. I think that most companies, again, you try to offer upfront what it is that you can provide for them, and they have an expectation on that, and they stop there. That's where the customer stops. But if you go that extra mile and just do one little thing that catches them off guard, it makes them remember you. An example is reward customer on large orders. We've actually done a couple of things where we've set a parameter that if a customer is, you know, 50% more than our average, you know, expected order amount, we actually generate a letter to them from our president, and we have him sign it. It is not just a, you know, compute, you know, it's not just a stamped signature, and we encourage them to give us, you know, feedback from that, and we just really give them a thank you. But we've had a great response to that. Just one little thing. Upgrade their shipping. Upgrade, you know, pick your parameters again. If it's a customer that has ordered from you for the fifth time in 2 months, you could make up any kind of, you know, parameters that you want to follow. But put it in place, because it's going to catch your customer off guard, and it's going to make them just, you know, be blown out of the water. We also pick some parameters where, I know I'm using the word parameter a lot, but, you know, pick your guidelines as far as maybe a bonus inventory gift. It would depend on what your product is, but David kind of picked up on this, that, you know, they will follow up with just a surprise little box of brownies. They weren't expecting it, and, you know, they were delighted to get it. Or a coupon towards a future purchase. You know, you could come up with all kinds of ideas. I will use Macy's as an example. They have their box, their brand. It's always nicely packed and comes, you know, when my expectation is. But the last one that I got, it had one little business card in it, and all it said was, thank you for making our day magic. And they expanded on, you know, their retail and their commercials, how they do their magic. And then it had a little signature on who packed my order. And again, enjoy and thank you again for shopping Macy's. It wasn't anything that was great. It really didn't give me anything except a smile on my face. But it makes me tell you about Macy's. David kind of expanded on this when he was talking about putting in a comment card or a feedback card. We also do the same thing. Let the customer tell you what they want. Offer them any opportunity to give you feedback. Enclose a customer satisfaction card. Encourage engagement on social channels. I know Lois had talked about, don't just put up there, you know, follow us on Twitter. Engage with them. And we have a wonderful following because we use it for just comments, and we let our customers, you know, put posts on our fan page, and we engage with them, and we chat back and forth. For a few weeks, we even had a coffee club. I mean, somebody started out with, I'm having hazelnut coffee this morning, and it went on for weeks. It was fun. offer several opportunities for feedback. Record your comments, just like David said. Listen and react. We do the same thing. We tabulate. We share with our customer service agents, not only for the, you know, when opportunities to coach them on doing a better job, but we also do it for, we have what we call a wall of fame. So every time we get a comment card back where somebody has, you know, told us that, you know, Susie did a wonderful job, and I wish everybody was like her. I mean, we blow it up and we put it on this wall so everybody can see it. And then go back and educate your staff. Lois said, you know your customer. It's one thing for management to know what the customer is, especially for prospecting and for trying to find, you know, new customers. But you've got to let your staff know what it is that your customer wants as far as, you know, share the feedback from your customer so that the staff will know how they can make an impact with your customer. And then let your staff educate you. They're the ones that engage with your customer. Let's face it, top management, as far as always having the answer, we don't. We can sit around brainstorm, but we're going to run out of ideas too. Your end line with the customer is your agents that chat with them, your agents that answer the emails, the agents that are talking to them on the phone. We use something here at Venus. We call it our straight from the customer form. And anybody that has any contact with the customer whatsoever, it could be in our returns department, and somebody wrote something on their little returns form. But we encourage every agent to put down what it is that our customer has told us. And then they feed that back to us. And, you know, especially for our swimwear, we design, manufacture, and control all of the swimwear that we sell. And I want to tell you, we probably have the best fit in the world because we always go and listen to our customer. You know, they'll come back and they're like, you know, the rise is a little too high, or I don't like the fat sides, or it fits too much like a bra. Make it more like a bathing suit top. And we have perfected this, and we have used this tool from our customers that have continually told our staff this, and we have perfected our product. And probably one of the most important things that you can do and to learn from, watch your competition. How are they delighting their customers? I know I just told you about Macy's. I just, for some reason, was so impressed by that, and it was such a little thing that we actually kind of changed our own thank you card because I was inspired by that. Not that Macy's is really a direct competitor for us, but you just have to take whatever it is that delights you and make it work for your company. We watch our competition. We look at their catalogs. We order from them. We see how their presentation is. I'm trying to think of who it was over the holidays. I believe it was Bath and Body Works. Actually shipped somebody here, something that they had ordered, and she brought it in because she was so impressed. She was so delighted with what she got. And it wasn't necessarily the product. It's a good product. But she had gotten a plain brown box, but when she opened it up, it had the blue and white gingham on the inside of the box. And she was just so wowed by that. So it kind of goes back to what David was saying. You pick what you want to invest in to make the customer want to order from you. All right. I think that's about it on our end. And again, like David and Lois both said, you need to come see us at our operations in May or our forum in May.
Yep, great. Thank you so much, everybody. Thanks to three great presentations. And, again, I just wanted to remind those listening about the special offer for the forum for cross-channel merchants. You can register with discount code WebROI for an extra $100 off at crosschannelforum.com. But in the meantime, we do have some questions that have come in, and I want to remind the listeners to please ask questions, ask away. We have about 15 minutes here to ask some questions. So I'm just going to start in with some of the ones that have come in. So, David, this one's directed to you. I'm not sure if you feel comfortable answering this, but one of the listeners was wondering about your use of Ecometry as an ERP platform. And I guess maybe, you can just briefly tell the listeners what an ERP platform is and what it does, and then whether or not you're still using it.
That's a good question, because I'm not sure what ERP exactly stands for, but we do use Ecometry. We've been using that system as our back-end order, order taking, order processing system, and we've been using it since 2004. And I was just going to I saw that question, and I was going to mention, too, that there'll be another session at the conference about challenges facing smaller operations. And a large part of what I'll be presenting are sort of IT solutions. And I know that, everybody's got their platform, their back end, and everybody's got pros and cons. And I really haven't found anybody that's completely 100% happy with their back-end software, and we've spent a lot of time writing surroundware. If you're familiar with the term surroundware, is basically tools and widgets that are designed specifically for our needs. They access the main system through the back end, through the database. And just a couple of examples, I had mentioned that we can receive orders that have as many as 1,000 addresses as a gift order. And, no system is really designed for that. So we designed something that on the outside of the main system to easily enter 1,000 addresses, address validate them, and then they just get sort of imported or plugged into the system. We also have those custom orders where we put logos on gifts, and so we've developed a system to track those in terms of the art and the proofs and getting it printed, and we've got a little tool to help us track it. We've also designed some reporting tools like a dashboard. Everybody, when they get to work, they can get on our intranet and hit the dashboard, and it's just a real quick graphic snapshot, how many packages we shipped, order value. We can compare this year versus last year. So there's a lot of opportunities to design some tools, and it's pretty low cost. We have an in-house programmer to do basically design tools that are really specifically for your business and outside of the main system.
So is that true that you're seeing, is that a sort of a trend where people are sort of building these kind of systems in-house versus using vendors, or is it just...
The terms, I only learned the term surroundware a few years ago, but I am hearing it more and more, and no system is going to be designed perfectly for your business, and that leads to an opportunity to just do some. All the tools that we've designed are browser-based, so you just open a web browser and you can access all these tools, and they're just grabbing data from the back end and presenting it to us the way we need it. Another example, we get a lot of orders via fax and email at the holidays, so we call it a Faxalog, and it's a web-based tracking system to keep track of all the emails and faxes that come in that are orders so that we don't lose track of anything.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great, excellent. Thank you for that great answer.
Sure.
There's a couple of questions that have come in about the feedback card that I believe, Lois, you were discussing. So I'm going to sort of go into that area. The first one is, what percentage of customers respond to a feedback card, I guess, in general? And do you have a follow-up process to a negative feedback card?
Yeah, that was actually Lisa, so I'll let her tackle that
one. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I know David had said that they also use it, but we do. It's in every outbound order. And just like David said, it's a postage paid, so it doesn't cost them anything to send it back. If I were to guess, we probably have about a 20% response, which is good. And, considering all the packages that go out, some customers will send it back with their return if they have to return or an exchange. Some people will take advantage of, just mailing it back to us. And what we do is we have one central area that does the tabulation, and we keep track of, I want to say we have about 12 questions, and we also take the opportunity on our feedback card to try and gather, would you like us to send a catalog to a friend? So we get a request. Hopefully we get a requester out of it also. But what we'll do is we'll tabulate. Just like David said, we do, how do you rate us, good to bad, by a numeric. And we watch, because we always want to stay on the good side. And if they give us feedback, like I said, if it's good, we have a name or an order number we can relate back to. We will make a big deal out of it with the agent, and we'll post it on what we call our wall of fame. And then we also, though, will give the feedback to the various areas. So if it has anything to do with our clothing, with our design of our swimwear, and management then has the opportunity to follow up.
And I'll add to that, Elisa, that we get on our card less than that, probably around 10% response rate. But at the end of the season, that's going to be over 10,000 cards for us. So it's plenty of data, coming right from the customer. And one other way we get feedback is on the web. When you finish an order with us, we participate in the program called BizRate, and it allows the customer to take a survey at the end of the order, and we do get a lot of responses from that. We get daily emails with comments that customers are, giving us feedback, and we find those very valuable.
And I do see that one of the questions is a follow-up to a negative feedback.
Yeah.
I know that David had said in his presentation that, they follow up, with the training and coaching opportunity. We will follow up with everyone that we can with the customer. Because we, again, like he said, we want them to know that we heard them, we saw their comments, and we appreciated the fact that they let us know about it.
Excellent. Great. Let's see. There was a question that came in, I guess this is sort of for everybody, about digital catalogs for tablets, which is a hot topic, as you know. Can each of you sort of give me some feedback on that? Do you think, maybe Lois, you could start. Do you see this as a channel, a need for this channel, or a channel that's going to grow?
Sure. A digital catalog online is not a bad thing, and it's so affordable nowadays that it's good to begin dabbling in that. And many companies have found that customers prefer to buy through the digital online catalog. Now, as far as tablets go, David has a great answer for this that I'm sure he'll share the experience. But what we're finding is that, it's a great experience to try and do it, but we're just not seeing that much activity at this point going through that. And it really has to do with that proactive tap on the shoulder. It's still a little bit relying on people to go to it when they think of it rather than like mail that might tap, someone on the shoulder. Plus, some of these companies, like Google Catalogs or Kellogg's, Spree, and some of these others, you know, the onus is really on them to advertise and pull people in. And it can't really be on the brand itself because they're having to give, you know, a cut of their profits in some cases to these pushers. Mm-hmm. Or it's almost like an affinity program. But, David, I know you've had a lot of experience in this, so I'll pass it off to you.
All right. Well, we went live on four catalog apps this season, which was Google Catalogs, Catalog Spree, Coffee Table, and Catalog by the Find. And like Lois said, you know, the conversion volume has been okay, but we feel like, you know, we do want to be there competing with our competition. But I think the longer term issue is that they're all basically a glorified PDF, and there's some disadvantages to that, you know, particularly needing to sort of zoom in to read anything. And where we see the opportunity with tablets is to develop, you know, an application, an app that is going to be more of an interactive experience. So in our example, that'd be like, you know, someone needs a gift, and we walk them through some questions that leads them to the perfect gift for their occasion. And that's just going to be a bigger investment for us, and we're not ready to jump in just yet. So it'll be interesting to see this coming year how the catalog apps that are out there, you know, if the conversion rate does continue to increase, because although it's small, it has been growing, you know, mm-hmm. since last holiday season.
Do you have any experience with that, Elisa, at Venus?
You know, we have dabbled with, you know, like the Google, the catalog. Not much for us to pay that much attention to. We just went live with our own, you know, mobile site. Our customer seems to be reacting to that. So, you know, the channel is doing well for us. But as far as, you know, having the actual digital catalog, we haven't seen much interest in it yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Let's see. There's a couple more questions, but please, everyone, you know, we have some great experts on the line here, so we'd love your questions. Don't be shy. But let's see. This is going back. I'm sure this was Lois's discussion about the profiles that you talked about. Is there, like, an ideal number for how many profiles you should identify?
Yeah, that's a great question. First of all, I want to back up a bit. When you're developing these personas, it's really important that you begin with your best customer base, not your entire customer base, including some of your requester file, because your best customer files, however you define that, are going to reflect back to you what your brand is all about, and that's what you're really trying to understand. You can't market to everybody. All brands can't be all things to all people. So with that said, what we have seen is that when you define, you know, your better customer segments and then place some of these psychographic overlays onto them, that clearly the biggest percentage of your customers are more homogenous than you think and will typically, I'd say around 60, even some up to 70% will fall into one bucket. And that's the one that you really want to keep your eye on. Now, sometimes we've seen it lower than that. And that shows the need more for a secondary and maybe a tertiary. But it's been pretty similar across the brands we've worked with, where a second follow-up customer might represent 20 or 30% of your file, and then the tertiary is usually fairly small, 10 to 15. Now, here is the problem. Sometimes we want to market to that tertiary person because they may look better, or we want to try and attract more of them. And if you go too far that way, you could really turn your back on that primary customer. So you have to be careful with getting too many of them. And then especially if you're a B2B brand, or if you market to two different people, like a mother and then the decision maker being the teenager, those are clearly two distinctly different personas that you need to look at. And even in the B2B world, where you might be marketing to two completely different verticals, you know, each one will need to have their own primary and secondary. So hopefully that answers the question.
That sounds great. Let's see, another question just came in, and this was about social sites. And we did touch on that a little bit, but I guess we could sort of delve into it a little bit more. The listener wanted to know if if there's sort of some best practices around motivating people in his company to ask customers, I suppose, you know, customer service reps or whatever, to ask customers, if they would sign up for their social sites or informing them of their social sites, like sort of getting the contact department involved, contact center.
I'll take a first stab at that. I think it goes back to the first part of my presentation, and that is to really understand your customer and understand why they come to you. If you're a brand that's all about making something easier for them, if you're a B2B brand, say, for instance, and you provide an easier solution, then all of your call to actions, whether it be online, on the phone, within your mail versions, whatever it might be, you want to weave in the why, weave in the reasons they come to you to begin with, so that it will motivate them to actually do that. But you're asking more, you know, how do I motivate people within the company? If they understood the benefit of what your customers are going to gain by doing so, they probably are going to be more comfortable in asking that. And I would recommend, and we've done this with some of our clients, a little role-playing, you know, based on certain things that they ask. Say, oh, yeah, well, you know, you're really going to find an easier solution. Have you tried Facebook? Have you tried, you know, following us on Twitter? We can provide those kind of things for you. So understanding the customer need and the real benefit that you as a brand provides them, it becomes much more natural for your call center or reps to get it, and they're more comfortable in inviting them in. Hopefully that answered the question.
That sounds great. Does anyone have anything they wanted to add to that, or Lisa, or
No. I think like I said, we have our we push to our Facebook page, and then we also have what they call, you know, call a fan page, and that's
mm-hmm.
where our fans can actually, you know, join us and make comments. And again, maybe it's something as simple as, you know, we had to kind of scale back on the coffee club, but it was just so funny how it started. It was just a fan that was like sitting here drinking my hazelnut coffee, looking at your catalog,
right.
and we started engaging. And the next morning, it was like, oh, I'm having Kona coffee this morning, and so we went on for about a week. Well, then finally, we kind of had to scale back because it was becoming all about coffee and not about our apparel, but. But it was interesting to see how many people actually did engage with us. So it might just take something cute, you know, to motivate them.
Mm-hmm. And you, do you have an active social presence, David?
We do. Yeah, we have. It's shared among three team members to monitor the Facebook site and our Twitter site, and then we also have a very active blogging campaign, which is. Really, probably more so for search engine optimization than direct customer engagement. But we do generate a lot of content, and we feed that right to the Facebook page. So that does get a little more people to read the blog. And then I would just add, as far as motivation, motivating your people, because that was part of this question, we do have a policy that's been really effective, and we call it the $100 empowerment policy. And so we've given all of our customer service team members the authority to spend up to $100 of the company's money to solve a problem. And that has been very effective, and we've been doing it, oh, gosh, at least 10 years now. And it really helps the customer service reps handle the calls. First call resolution, they don't need to escalate. Most of our problems are easily handled for less than $100, and that's been a great motivator for the team members to engage with the customers.
We only have a minute here, but that's really interesting. Could you give the listeners an example of a $100 sort of a solution that came up with the $100? Isn't that be really interesting?
Yeah, well, so the customer orders a box of brownies for a birthday. The box of brownies arrives one day late. So the customer's upset. They call in to complain. We sort of escalate, oh, can I refund your shipping? Well, you know, I'm still angry. Well, can I go ahead and refund your shipping and your product? Oh, okay, that's better, but I'm still upset. Well, why don't I go ahead and refund the entire order and send you a small box of brownies to, you know, apologize? Okay, that whole thing cost less than $100, and we've turned in, you know, we've turned around a complainer to, you know, someone who's going to rave about the company and spread all that goodwill.
Great, excellent, excellent. Well, that's good to end this session on an upbeat note. I think we'll have to looks like we're out of time, but on behalf of the Direct Marketing Association and our wonderful speakers, I want to thank you all for attending today's webinar, and also be sure to check out our webinar page to get information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars, and that's at retailonlineintegration.com/webinars. With that, thanks a lot, everybody, and have a great day.